From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. First this morning, John Wells and I talk with Dr. Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, about the collaboration between NASA and NOAA and the enormous task of measuring the average temperature of the Earth using many thousands of measurements all around the planet to calculate global 2022 temperatures. Then, Bonnie Mann, director of the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair, joins to tell us about the fascinating school science and engineering projects at this year's fair. And no, it isn't NASA that has a carbon fiber curing experiment on the ISS, but a high school student. These guests, when we return, stay with us.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Katie Mullally. Each year, NASA and NOAA undertake the enormous task of measuring the average temperature of the Earth using many thousands of measurements all around the globe. Today's temperature data comes from many sources, including more than 32,000 land weather stations, weather balloons, radar, ships, buoys, satellites, and 8,700 volunteer citizen observers who log daily their weather data. Our next guest is Gavin Schmidt. He's the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and he's NASA's senior climate advisor. Gavin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks. Just a quick update. I was the NASA's senior climate advisor. I am no longer.
Okay.
But, you know, perhaps I'm just a little bit more junior.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Well, we are delighted to have you on the program. And, you know, there's so many moving pieces involved in putting together this annual exercise, this report. Mm-hmm. So let's start with this. What is NASA's role? What is NOAA's role? And how do you all work together?
Well, we do work together. That's really quite the thing. So the weather station data that comes from all around the world comes from weather services, right? So the Met Office in the UK, and there are equivalent services in almost every country around the world. Those are collated by NOAA through the National Center for Environmental Information at Asheville, North Carolina, and they make that data available for everybody to look at. But they're really just a conduit for all of those international data sources. We take that data, we process it, we, you know, try and fill in some of the gaps using what we understand about climate processes, and we make estimates of how much any station is different from its past climate, and then by linking all of those differences together, we get an estimate of how different this month or this year is compared to the baseline climatology.
Mm. And preparing for our talk this afternoon, I was reading that in the 1940s, the way they determined what the ocean temperature was they would throw a wooden bucket in the water, they'd pull it up and measure the temperature with a thermometer. The technology's changed a bit in the last 80 years, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. So most of this data, you know, and this data goes back to the 19th century or even the 18th century in some places. This data was never really collected with this idea that we'd be able to track things through time. You know, it was often done just, I just want to see kind of what temperature it is right now. Or and then as we became, you know, better weather forecasters, it was to forecast the weather. Mm. And so all of these data series are plagued with colloquially known as non-climatic influences. So things that have just changed because people swapped out one kind of thermometer for another. Or as you mentioned, in the ocean, people would measure things using a wooden bucket on the deck, and then they moved to special kinds of buckets, and then they moved to taking the temperature of the engine intake water. And that's always coexisted with, you know, people putting down sensitive instruments that go all the way down and come back all the way up. And now we have free floating buoys, which drift with the currents, move up and down through the column. And then when they get to the surface, they radio their results back up via a satellite. And then we get a much deeper and more comprehensive view of the ocean through that. But each of those methods is slightly different. And so if you compare them, if you compare those methods in the same place, right, they're often a little bit offset, you know, maybe a degree, maybe a half of a degree, but these are systematic things. And because that network has changed over time, if you don't take that out, then all you see is the biases accumulating. You don't see the climate. And so you have to make a very thorough effort to remove those biases. And we've not us specifically, but the community as a whole has made enormous strides on being able to better model those uncertainties and model those changes and then include them in the assessed changes over time. So we now have a lot less, I think, uncertainty in how things have changed than we had even 10 years ago.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking with Dr. Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Well, Dr. Schmidt, NASA and NOAA just released the global temperature data for 2022. Mm-hmm. Where does that year rank in terms of hottest years on record?
Well, it was around the fifth or sixth warmest. The ranking is a little bit subjective. It depends a little bit on the methodology you use. We use a particular methodology. NOAA has their own methodology. The Met Office in the UK has their own methodology. There are other efforts. And so there's a little bit of difference between those, and that affects sometimes the rankings because there's not very much difference between, 2022 and 2017 and 2015, for instance. But the key thing to remember is not the ranking of any individual year, but rather that this is a culmination of a very long-term trend, and that, this is what we're expecting because we know that the climate is changing. We know that we're changing the climate. And so as things are moving, sometimes you have a little bit more of a warm year, like 2016 was an enormously warm year on top of that trend. 2019 was a little bit cooler year on top of that trend. And that depends on things like El Nino and La Nina. And we've just had like kind of 3 years of La Nina effects, which is a cooling in the tropical Pacific. And so, the last few years haven't been record breaking, but they've still been, top five, top 10 years. And now, we're starting to see that break, right? So if you look at the El Nino indices or the sea surface temperature patterns in the tropical Pacific right now, what you see is that we're moving towards either neutral or El Nino conditions by the end of this year. And so that's going to give us a boost a little bit this year, but mostly next year. And so we're expecting that 2023 is going to be warmer than 2022. And if that prediction of the El Nino pans out, then we would probably expect 2024 to be a record-breaking year once again.
Wow. Well, here in Utah, we're 200% snowfall. It's been very cold. And like I said, the weather this year has been very cold, but we know that weather isn't climate.
Right.
So the climate is warming, but this year doesn't seem to reflect it, at least here in Utah. How do we explain this? How do we explain this to people that just because we are colder right now these last few months doesn't mean that the climate is colder?
So no, it doesn't. So every winter we see a lot of variability. And so we'll see places that are like much, much warmer than normal and places that are much cooler than normal. And so the pattern this winter was very much kind of split down the middle of the U.S. The east side of the U.S. has had record warm winters. We just had a record warm March. We had almost no snow. There was no snow in Philadelphia. We had 1 inch of snow in New York City. And so everything is everything is seeing a bit of an early spring here. And conversely, we had this massive rainfall and snowfall in the Sierras in California. You mentioned Utah. Alaska has been doing something similar. And what these are reflections of you know, the patterns of jet stream variability. And these can be very noisy or they can be quite flat. And this year was a very noisy year. And so that's when we get these big extremes of winter warming and winter cooling in different parts of the group. But when you look at the global mean temperatures, right, and you stack it up, then, you know, it's the oceans that really kind of determine that. And the oceans are like, super warm. I think there's one analysis that says that the ocean temperatures right now are as warm as they have ever been measured. And that's even before we start to get this El Nino effect. So there are long-term trends and then there's noise, and you have to be able to see, you know, those, you have to be able to pick out the trends from the noise. Sometimes that's a little hard, which is why people get confused, I think. But when you look on those long-term trends, you know, we see that winters are getting warmer, right? We see that snowfall on average is decreasing and moving poleward, right? You know, we can see, you know, the ice retreating from the mountain glacier areas, from Greenland, from Antarctica. We can see the sea level rising. All of these things are consistent patterns associated with a long-term trend in warming.
Gavin, on June 1st kicks off the beginning of the Atlantic hurricane season for 2023. What sort of things can we expect?
So I'm not a huge expert on hurricanes. We know that there are long distance connections between the tropical Pacific and the hurricane thing, but we're also seeing enormously warm temperatures in the main development region. So I don't personally make predictions for tropical cyclone numbers and the like, but my guess is that people will be expecting a relatively busy season, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, what I was interested to learn about would be, I think 2005 and 2015 were a couple of years where we had some pretty strong hurricane activity. And I was curious if there was anything unusual during the months leading up to those years that that may, you know, lend a hand in the strength of the season.
Well, yeah, I mean, so people make statistical predictions of the strength of the season, and they seem to be skillful. And the ingredients that go into that are, you know, the temperatures in the main development region. So that's mm-hmm. kind of in the northern subtropics of the Atlantic, the state of the gradient in the Atlantic. So, you know, as it gets colder towards the north, is that you know, a big gradient or a small gradient, that makes a difference. The state of tropical Pacific, that makes a difference because it affects what's called the Walker circulation across the equator. And so, you know, you can go back in time and you can match these things up, and there is some skill in predicting things there. And so the forecast that you'll see in the next couple of months, they will be based on those kind of statistical connections.
Good.
Well, back in 2014, you gave a TED Talk on the emerging patterns of climate change. Now, granted, that was 9 years ago. How have the patterns changed since 2014?
That's a great question. So the overall patterns haven't changed at all, right? So we're seeing basically more of the same. Like what we predicted, quite frankly, in the 1990s has actually happened and continues to happen. And, you know, normally scientists were supposed to take great pleasure in the fact that we made successful predictions, but we don't. We didn't want to be right. We don't want to be right, but unfortunately we are. So it's troubling as a scientist and then as a citizen. You know, you're a little bit confused by that. I'm a little bit confused by that. But what we have seen is as the magnitude of climate change has increased, we're seeing more and more the impacts of that climate change, not just on relatively esoteric measures like the global mean temperature, right? Who lives in the global mean? Nobody lives in the global mean, right? But we're now seeing with more than 1 degree Celsius, around 2 degrees Fahrenheit, warming since the pre-industrial. We're seeing impacts on intense rainfall. We're seeing impacts on intensity and frequency of heat waves. We're seeing impacts on intensity of storms, intensity of drought. We're seeing the changes in water resources. We're seeing the changes in evaporation. There's a lot more things now that people locally can point to and say, yeah, no, this is changing because of climate change and it's affecting us right now. And so, you know, maybe in 2014, people were still thinking, oh, it's an issue for the future. Oh, I don't need to worry about it. I've not seen any difference. But like now, you can see it. You can see it locally. You can see it in your town, in your city, in your village, in your fields, in your areas. I mean, you don't need to... you don't need to squint, right? It's plain as day.
Well, you think of it, there's over 40,000 data sources coming in to NASA and NOAA for these global temperature studies. Mm-hmm. Probably, did you have that many back and forth in 2014? And of these 40,000, it's what are they comprised of?
Right. So what's been great over the last 20 years is how much more data is available. And that's through digitization. It's through more automated sensors. It's through better communications. And that's allowed us to go beyond, you know, our initial estimates, which were based on, you know, a few hundred stations. Right. And there, and we didn't have any information from the ocean. And we were trying to say, well, what's going on? And so obviously the uncertainty when you're doing it then, that's shrunk now because now we have a lot more data. A lot of it is redundant, thankfully. Right. So, you know, if one is doing something a little bit weird, you know, it will be obvious that that's weird and we should discard it. Right. So it becomes much easier to do the quality control that you need to do. We've been able to do more and we've been able to see more and more clearly.
Gavin, I wanted to ask you about technology. We've had Dahlia Kirschbaum on several times talking about the GPM, the Global Precipitation Measurement Satellite. Size of a school bus does CAT scans of hurricanes. And that was technically advanced. I think it came out 3 or 4 years ago. There's some things that are even more advanced than that out now. And we have some other satellites in the constellation that are still in operation that are even, you know, probably maybe 10 years ago or so. And I'm curious about this. As we do temperature gathering and for weather prediction, how much technological advancement comes from hardware versus software? And of course, maybe versus more sophisticated algorithms. Where are we getting the most bang for the buck?
That's a great question. So in terms of miniaturization, I think that's, you know, the hardware thing is it's orders of magnitude we've gained. You know, the first spectrometers that were put into space to do hyperspectral imaging for radiation purposes and the like, those were the size of a bus. And now, you know, you can replace that functionality and do it better on a chip the size of your thumb.
Right.
So that's just incredible. And that allows for so much more stuff to be put into space. So, you know, this is why we're talking about small sats. We're talking about CubeSats. We're talking about constellations. That's where all that has come from. It's from the miniaturization of those sensors. As we go through time, you know, you mentioned the retrievals are getting better because we can, we can account for more things. We have more sensors that allow us to account for more things. We have a better understanding of radiative transfer. We have a better understanding of things like clouds and the surface processes. We still have a little bit of a gap when it comes to particles in the atmosphere, aerosols. So, you know, the amount of dust or sea salt or pollen or black carbon, all of those things in the air, we don't quite have a good idea about what's going on. But we do have a new mission that is going to be launched early next year called PACE, which is going to give us, for the first time, hopefully, if this works out, a kind of global view of exactly what the composition is. And that's going to be a step change in how useful some of these retrievals are. And then, putting it all together, Yeah, I mean, we're now improving the models and we're improving the data assimilation system so that we can use more and more of this data as more and more of this data becomes available. And that allows us to make better predictions. If you look at the weather forecasts, the skill in weather forecasts has improved enormously in the last 20 years. You know, so the skill of a 3-day forecast 20 years ago is now the skill of a 5-day forecast. And the skill of a 5-day forecast is now the skill of a 7-day forecast. You know, so we're really pushing the envelope for useful weather forecasts as a function of all of those things: better data, better retrievals, and better processing.
Gavin, with the new climate, we've worked really hard to try to understand and plan for the consequences of the new climate. What are some of the unintended consequences that have really surprised us?
Well, you know, so that's a tricky one. You know, a lot of what we're seeing was predicted, and so things like increased coastal flooding and heat waves and intense rainfall, all of these things unfortunately were predicted ahead of time, so they're shocking but not surprising. You know, some of the shifts in growing season again were predicted, but that's not terrible. You know, we're seeing I don't know if you grow grapes in Utah, but for instance in Oregon and Washington State, the vineyards there are doing much better, you know, while in California they're kind of, you know, starting to struggle a little bit. So you know, there are these things that you can anticipate. But there are shocks to the system. I mean, take the pine bark beetle outbreaks, right? Mm-hmm. So now we look at them and we say, oh, okay, well, you know, it's because it's not getting cold enough in the winter and they're breeding more and that's causing a thing. But I don't think that was predicted ahead of time. You know, that was something, they have a trigger that's associated with temperature. And so I think the people who are looking at biological systems, ecosystems, I think they're finding more surprises in the greenhouse than perhaps the physical climate scientists.
And of course, you're from the UK, and they are claiming that they are making a better champagne grape in the UK than the Champagne province of France.
Well,
and
this is actually
a response. Yeah.
So it turns out that geologically, the terroir, if you like, of the Champagne region, which is in northern France, and the South Downs of the UK, which is a little bit further north, are very similar, very chalky soils, very similar climates. And as things have warmed, the temperature in and the rain patterns in the southern England have now matched what it used to be in France. And now the French, it's a little bit too warm for Champagne grapes. Mm-hmm. And you know, the volume is not there yet, right? So, you know, I mean, you're not gonna, and it's still quite expensive, but but if you're in the UK, I recommend at least trying some of the English champagne. It really is excellent quality. And in fact, has won prizes in blind tastings against sparkling wine from Champagne. And so obviously that's very annoying to the French, but.
Katie and I love to do research.
Yeah.
So if you do research on English wine, it's kind of funny. There was a Punch, which was a satirical magazine in the Victorian period, and they had a cartoon, and it says, "How many people does it require to drink English wine?" And it said 5, one person to drink it, and 4 people to hold him down.
Oh, that's hysterical. Gavin Schmidt is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And Katie and I have really enjoyed this conversation. We wish you and your entire program continued success. And thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally. When you hear of a project titled The Effect of Porosity of Acoustic Materials on Sound Reduction, it's easy to assume that it's being conducted at a university level. Nope, this was a Utah elementary school student. It would also be easy to assume that it was NASA who created a project to study carbon fiber curing in space. No, again, that is a Utah high school student who actually has his carbon fiber curing experiment in space. Here to tell us more about these and other fascinating school science and engineering projects is Brenda Mann, Program Director of the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair. Brenda, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So before we go into this year's winners and so many of the titles that I cannot pronounce, tell us about the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair that was just recently held that I had the pleasure of going to one day.
So the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair is a regional fair, which means kids compete at school level fairs, and from there, the best of those move on to their district level fair. And from the district, the best of those move on to the regional fair, which we held. There are several regional fairs in the state of Utah. So ours covers Salt Lake District, Granite, Canyons, Tooele, I'm forgetting a bunch of them, South Summit. We've got the private schools, charter schools, the Salt Lake Diocese. So there's a lot of schools and districts that are feeding into our fair. And so it's over three days, and it's fifth grade through 12th grade.
So how did the fair get started? And I love the fact that it's a science and engineering fair, because it used to just be science fairs, which meant volcanoes that would bubble up when we were, you know, kids.
Right. It has evolved a lot since then, when they were just science demonstrations sometimes and not actual experiments. And the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair has been around for quite a while. It used to be called the Salt Lake Valley Science and Engineering Fair, and it's been around at least 20 years. I have been with it for the last 17 years. Jody Ostema is our program manager, and she's been with it, I believe, for 19 years. So pretty much from the beginning, when it started out of the Utah Science Center at the Leonardo, and eventually we moved it to the University of Utah.
I was lucky enough to go down a couple of weeks ago to the high school day, and there was probably 30 kids there, maybe 40.
There were, I think, 63 projects there this year for high school. So a few more than...
Okay, well, good. Even better. The level of science and engineering that was displayed, again, just a three-sided poster board that these kids showed was astounding. You would expect this from a college level. Were these the cream of the crop? Did these kids have to go through a selection process to make it to the final 63?
Yeah, so our high school projects, they are going through school and district fairs. A lot of them are moving on. We do want any, for high school, certainly, we want as many of the top level projects. So a lot of them, the districts have, the students who are competing there are such high level, we're willing to take a lot of these students on. And you're right, they are, some of these, you know, I have a PhD, some of them, I look at it and I say, my goodness, some of the stuff are things that there are PhD students working on. And it is amazing that in high school that they are even thinking about some of these topics, let alone able to work on them. And some of them aren't working in university labs. Some are, but some are able to work on these in their home, and they're getting sometimes help from not a lot of people. Sometimes they have parent support, sometimes they have other mentors.
A couple of my favorites was Cade Hunter did.
Yes, Cade is awesome. That was an amazing project.
He did a reverse pedaling bike. So ask him about that. Always my first question is, how did you come up with this? And this great kid said his uncle has knee problems, and said that it was easier on his knees to walk backwards. And then he also said that his uncle found it was more comfortable to pedal backwards on a stationary bike. So brilliant little Cade said, well, why don't we create a backward pedaling bike? I mean, sorry, a bike that goes forward as you pedal it backwards. I would have loved to have seen it in real life, because these kids can only have the three-sided poster boards. But the amount of ingenuity and engineering that went into that simple yet very complex idea. What have been some of your favorite kids over the years?
You know, that's really hard. It's hard to play favorites. I've had so many. And you're right. A lot of them come from kids are thinking about things, they see a problem around them. And whether they're, you know, doing something at home or not, they really want to find solutions to problems. They want to investigate more. They want to try to understand what's going on in the world around them. There are so many kids, right, that you either hear about something like cancer and they're like, well, why aren't we doing this? Why can't we find a simpler method to treat it? Or how can we get drugs that might be coming from nature and get a more simple kind of solution, a simpler treatment to everybody in the world? And they're not just thinking in local, they're thinking globally. And it's crazy that, you know, we have some of these students working on some of this.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're talking to Brenda Mann, Program Director of the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair. Well, Brenda, the idea that these kids find problems that we didn't even think about and ways to correlate the problems to their ideas is fascinating to see. And I'm so happy to see this being taught like all the way down through fifth grade. The one project that I referenced in the intro, the effects of porosity of acoustic materials on sound reduction. Is this fifth grader trying to create materials around his bedroom so that they can have the sound up as loud as possible? Where do they come up with these ideas?
You know, honestly, sometimes it's in school. They are, you know, learning about something and a question will pop into their head. And for some of them, they cannot get that question out of their head. And maybe their teacher doesn't know, or maybe their teacher says, you know, that's a great question. I don't know. Let's investigate. Or you know, it might be something you want to ask your parents. And sometimes they'll have a parent that they find out, oh, I'm working on this and there's something in their garage that their parent is working on. And the kid's able to say, well, why don't you try this? And the parent says, well, nobody's ever done that, you know? And so I think a lot of these ideas that they come up with are really, they're either a kernel of something that's starting having to do with a topic they're learning in school. They're coming from observations around them as they're going around, or they've got a parent or an older sibling sometimes that they just are starting to learn about, that having the internet accessible and just reading some things or hearing sometimes about, you know, something on TV. And yes, there is a kid looking at various blood spatter patterns and what that could mean. I mean, they're already getting into interested in forensic science. And no, they weren't actually working with blood. They were using simulated materials, you know, for their experiment. But it's tremendous that they're even looking at these.
There was two high school students that I was talking to about detecting, their project was developing new ways to detect Alzheimer's through blood pressure and heart rate. And I just look at these I hate to keep calling them kids, but they are. And you just think of they have such a bright future ahead of them. Where do a lot of these kids, okay, do you follow these kids after they go through this program? And where do a lot of them end up?
Yes, we do. We do try to follow them as much as possible, especially those that have made it onto the International Science and Engineering Fair. So that's the highest fair that our high school students can move on to. And we do try to track them, and we have a lot of them let us know what they're doing. Most of them have gone on to tremendous schools, including the University of Utah, including Westminster, right, you know, schools right in our backyard that are fabulous research institutions as well. And then there are kids that go on to Stanford and Berkeley and MIT. And it's funny because I was just texting with one of our students who went to the International Fair quite a few years ago now that I keep in touch with. And he went to Stanford and he has a PhD and he's now a machine learning engineer at Mosaic. And he worked on, you know, for Facebook AI for a while. And they're moving on to absolutely phenomenal positions, and the things that they're doing in life and the people they're helping is just amazing.
Well, and talk about the people that they're helping. I was talking with one of the students and her project was working on mental health of veterinarians. Yes. And I typically wouldn't have associated that with a science and engineering fair, but that is just as much science-based as a
backward pedaling bicycle. And the care that she showed and the concern that she showed for these veterinarians who have typically been overlooked, I guess, in terms of medical mental health. How long have this clinical end and this mental health end been involved in the science fair?
From the beginning of at least the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair, and back when it was Salt Lake Valley Science and Engineering Fair, there's always been this category that's called behavioral and social sciences. And they are, as you mentioned, they are science. They're doing experiments where you have a hypothesis and you're developing testing that can look into whether your hypothesis is correct or not and move on from there. And the number of aspects that go into the mental health, it is health, it's science, as I said, the behavioral and sometimes social aspects. So it's been around for quite a while, and some of those students we do take to the international fair as well. And yeah, it's interesting. I was really happy to see that somebody had looked into veterinarians' mental health. I co-founded a company that's veterinary medicine based, and I've interacted with a lot of veterinarians in my time with that. And it does feel like sometimes they are overlooked in the medical sciences, but they are a big part of it. They're very highly trained scientists. And just as with anybody else, mental health can be a concern.
Who are the judges that you bring in?
We have judges kind of from all over. We do try to get scientists and engineers, you know, that have been in their field for a long time. They're not all PhDs or master's degrees, but they all have been working in their fields for quite a while. Usually we do have a lot from the University of Utah who come, you know, upper level graduate students also typically will judge for us. And yeah, so community members, the best part of this that I see is when the kids get to interact with the judges, because they're talking to people who are working in this field, and the judges are giving them suggestions on things that they could do next. Or, you know, sometimes the kids have questions. Sometimes the kids are doing things that the judges hadn't even thought about. Mm-hmm. And it's quite heartwarming, I guess, in some ways to see that. But what I love is the encouragement that's given to all of these students to continue to pursue science and engineering. Sometimes they aren't always given that kind of support in terms of their project. So many of them really do need this extra boost, and it's very helpful for them to be able to interact with people in the field.
When I was there, the ability of these students to clearly explain to me their project, and some of them, English was their second language, and they did such a great job of detailing and explaining in a, you know, to a layman's, in layman's terms. I mean, my degrees were in science communication. And so to really immerse myself in how these kids explained their project was a fascinating component of the whole fair. So what are the components that the kids are judged on in these projects?
So part of it is on their project, you know, from start to finish, kind of what was their hypothesis or an engineering project? What was your problem you're trying to solve? Making sure that they've done some of their background to understand some of it. How did they design their experiments? Were they designed in order for a science one? Were the experiments designed in order to test their hypothesis properly? Engineering, do they have design criteria? Are they then making their prototype and revising based on whether it met their design criteria? There's kind of a loop that happens in engineering design. And kind of their conclusions, like looking at their data, are they able to kind of say, what does this mean? And it's, a you know, age appropriate, right? The fifth and sixth graders are judged a little differently than the seventh and eighth graders and versus the high school students. But kind of being able to put everything in context, and as I said, what does this all mean? Where does this fit in the bigger picture? Some of it is on their presentation. How well do they communicate? And that's kind of an interesting aspect that a lot of people don't think about, but in science and engineering, it's critical that you're able to communicate your results, anything that you've found, and in order to work with other people, but also to move everything forward, to move science and engineering forward, we have to be able to talk about what we've done and what it means and where we go next.
Where do the winners of this year's science fair go next?
So there are a few projects, four projects this year that were chosen to move on to the International Science and Engineering Fair. That will be held in Dallas in May. There are usually about 1,700 students from, I think it's like 50-something countries around the world competing. It's an incredible, incredible thing to witness and be there. And if you think some of those, the titles at our fair were complicated, now there's like 1,700 of those that are just as complicated. There were also four projects chosen to move on to the Genius Olympiad, which will be held in June in up in Rochester. That's also a global competition. It is for students working on environmental projects specifically. So they'll be competing there. And then the top 10% of our sixth through eighth graders of their projects were selected to apply for now called the Thermo Fisher Junior Inventors Challenge. It's quite a mouthful, but that's a national competition for middle school students.
So have any of these projects been picked up by a university or a company or NASA straight from the science fair? Because again, the carbon fiber curing in space, it's actually on the International Space Station right now. You know, has there been that leap from science fair into production?
Not that I'm particularly aware of it in like a larger standpoint. There have been, there was a student working on a particular kind of, I believe it was a solar powered cooking unit years ago that they were finally trying to make and take to some third world countries. There have been students that have gotten patents on some of their projects, and there's a company that may be starting based on one of them, but yeah, so there is a little bit of that going on. There hasn't been a lot, but
yeah, there is. Again, going through some of the projects this year, we've talked about the very complex ones, the Alzheimer's detections, the backward pedaling bike, but there was also a student who created a self-opening levelor contraption, if you will. I know I'm
yes,
naming it
yeah.
horribly.
Yeah, just yeah. The blinds, window
the blinds.
Blinds.
It would yes. open the blinds. And that was cool in and of itself. But then she goes, oh, wait, I have an app that I've developed so that I can turn this on. And so the layers of development and thought and ingenuity that come along with these projects is not just making the bike pedal backwards. It's not just curing the carbon fiber in space or opening the windows. There are so many facets to their projects, and I'm sure this has grown over the years. I mean, have you seen an expansion of an overall scope of their projects?
Yes, there are quite a few students who end up doing multi-year projects.
Wow.
And so in the rules governing, so we have the International Science and Engineering Fair rules kind of that help dictate what we can have the students do. So they can do a multi-year project, but they can only present 1 year worth of stuff. But we do see kids start on a project and they have these ideas for how to move it forward. And so the next year they will have made a bunch of progress. Now it's that progress that they're presenting the next year, but sometimes they've taken it for, you know, up to 3 and 4 years. These wow. do become very large projects that in a way you feel like, is this consuming this kid's life, right? That they're working so hard on it and they're putting in so many hours. But there are a lot of projects that do have that level of complexity that it just keeps going. And that's kind of what happens when you're getting, say, your PhD, is things are just evolving. That's why it's taking years and years and years for people to do the research to get their PhD, because there are so many things that you can actually look at related to some of these science and engineering projects.
Sounds like they should have a PhD by the time they graduate high school if they start on these projects in fifth grade. Well, again, I'm fascinated with the projects, looking through the through the winners list. Something as simple as do bees pollinate lavender versus the soil, the dust coming out of Salt Lake, and what sort of sensors we have in our cells to pick up the toxins. The scope of these projects is enormous. It's, do they have parameters that they have to stay within, or can they do everything from bees to cellular biology?
There are certain rules, and it's really around safety. And so there are certain things that they need to, if they're working with hazardous chemicals, they need to be working in a proper environment with that. They need to have the proper supervision. The same thing if they're, you know, working with mammalian cells, there are only particular kinds of environments where those are going to grow. You're going to need to be working in a lab where you have the proper oversight and the proper equipment to be working with some of that. So there are some restrictions in terms, you know, just making sure they're safe, and they do have to submit their paperwork to us so that we can make sure that they're being safe. But otherwise, it's in a way, the sky's the limit to a certain extent, right? There's only, you know, the resources that are available to some of these students is often limited. But what they do with some of those limited resources is spectacular.
So for these kids, they have created the experiment. They've created their prototypes either at home or in a safe school lab. And then they create what I think is amazing, all of their data, all of the information put onto this one board. That in itself is a scientific endeavor.
Yes, it is. And again, that goes, part of that goes to the communication. What are the important aspects of it? What do I need to include, not include? They're putting this stuff up there as on their poster board, but some of them, you may have noticed, had notebooks and binders filled with their data. And some of them are like, oh, well, I looked into this aspect here, and they're flipping through their binder just to show you all this extra stuff they have. And you're like, I only have so much time. But they, the students, a lot of times really, really just want to chat with you about their project because they're so excited about what they did.
Yeah, they were so excited. It's so lovely to talk to. Now, for next year's science fair, is this open to the public?
We used to have public sessions, and the pandemic kind of killed that. Mm-hmm. Next year, we are hoping to bring it back. So we're trying to figure out the best way to do that so that the students can have their project set up and then have time for the public to come in and view the projects. And that's something that both the students, the parents, even the judges said that they really, really miss, is the time to go around and see a lot of the other things that are going on. Yeah. And it's a time for the parents to be able to celebrate with the kids getting to the regional fair and being able to show off what they've done.
Right. And not the, and the reason why the garages are probably a disaster at this point.
That's right.
Well, Brenda Mann, thank you so much for talking with us today on Cool Science Radio about the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair. This is where it all starts. These kids are the foundation of our science for tomorrow. And to see what is being creative and thought about and the problems that are being solved or even pointed out gives me a lot of hope in the science of the future. We will post a link to the University of Utah Science and Engineering Fair for all of our listeners to go on and see the list of this year's winners and other participants and see if they can pronounce the amazing titles and long words that were presented this year. Brenda, we hope to talk to you next year before next year's science fair and get some of our listeners down there to observe if it's open to the public.
Thank you so much for having me. Absolutely love doing this. And so I'm happy to kind of promote it away and love working with all of the kids and seeing what they've done.
They've done a great job and you've done a great job. So thank you so much.
Next week on Cool Science Radio, we'll be talking live in studio with the Clark Planetarium in Salt Lake City. It's their 20th anniversary and they have a wide array of fun events scheduled for the summer. We'll also be speaking with local fungi expert on all things, well, fungi. Did you know that fungi is its own separate kingdom? It's not a plant. It's not an animal. It's a fungi that blew my mind. And find the links to our past shows on kpcw.org in addition to our podcast. I highly recommend you go back in and check out the interview last week with local hydrologist Brian McInerney about snowpack and flooding. We're seeing the direct effects of his interview. Also, we've got other great guests from the past, Maureen McCarthy, who joined us to talk about atmospheric rivers, Jeremy Wagstaff on the real threat from AI, again, more and more prevalent. And then also listen to our interview with Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, and the importance of the night sky. Again, you're listening to KPCW in Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app.